Council, Mark Monterey, Attorney General, Congress, Acting Solicitor General, Mark McGuire, Acting Deputy Solicitor General, Craig Heffey, Salaries, and Attorney General, Acting.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Patrick Blanch, and I represent the appellant Nathan Shin. The Supreme Court of the United States, on at least two separate occasions, has held that the Fourth Amendment acts to protect an individual against government enforcement in a civil action, which is the nature of the case when the government seeks to revoke the driving privilege for the refusal to consent to a blood test under the implied consent statute. Both in Chandler v. Miller and Kamara v. Municipal Court of San Francisco, the court specifically made that finding.
So let's say that we concede that point to you. What about the breath test? It was either breath or blood in this, under the statement of facts that we applied.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It was a refusal to give a breath test or a blood test under the statement of facts.
No, Your Honor. That is unfortunately not correct for the government. The charging document doesn't say whether this is a case of breath or blood. The charging document speaks generally about that. But the
What about the statement of facts?
The statement of facts, which is binding on the court, says, quote, the arresting police officer demanded a blood and breath test from the defendant, blood first, but conjunctively, blood and breath test from the defendant, first orally and then by means of reading the implied consent declaration, end quote.
So do you believe that the officer was saying, I want to take a breath test and a blood test? Is that your
That's
your
the position? Only reading of the record that could be correct, Your Honor. And I'll tell the court why. To begin with, the Commonwealth and the court agreed and endorsed this statement of facts, which says blood and breath, that the officer demanded blood and breath.
Are you aware of any other situation where an officer has demanded both breath and blood from a defendant?
Indeed, Your Honor. That's happened in cases I've had before, but don't take my word for it. The Commonwealth cited a case called Fitzgerald from the Colorado Supreme Court earlier this year, in which the police officer demanded both breath and blood.
That's from Virginia. None that you're aware of in Virginia. Not being reported.
Your Honor, I've represented defendants who have had both breath and blood demanded from them.
But well, there wasn't a blood test in this case.
I'm sorry?
There was not a blood test in this case.
Correct. Mr. Shin.
So what is the significance of your argument if there only was a breath test?
There was no breath test or blood test, Your Honor.
The only thing that I understand that. That's what he's charged with, the failure to give a breath test. There wasn't a refusal of a blood test.
Your Honor, that is not what he was charged with. He was charged with the refusal to give a breath and blood test.
Can I jump in here? But the way the statute works, you don't get to the blood test unless he has a reason why he can't do the breath test.
That's not correct, Justice Kelsey.
Okay. We're all incorrect. Explain why.
The statute expressly permits the police officer to demand a breath and blood test if he has cause to believe that there are things in the person's blood beyond alcohol that can be detected by a breath test. The statute, by its own terms, permits the officer to demand both breath
but
and blood.
But that's not your case. That is not your case. Your case, they were anticipating a breath test for alcohol. They weren't anticipating
In the statement of facts to support that position.
Well, let me get back to your statement of facts where you said he demanded both a blood and a breath test. And then you go on, or the statement of facts goes on to say, and then by means of reading the implied consent declaration. So to the extent that the statement of facts incorporates the implied consent declaration, doesn't that clearly say you shall submit to a breath test if the breath test is not available or you're physically unable, then a blood test?
Your Honor, in the fifth line, the fourth to fifth line of the implied consent, I'll answer a quick no and then explain. In the fourth and fifth line, it says, you shall be deemed to have agreed as a condition of such operation to consent to have a sample of breath, comma, blood, comma, or both breath and blood taken for chemical testing.
Right, and then it goes on to explain, as I read it, the sequencing would be a breath test first if the breath test is unavailable or you're unable to submit, then a blood test. Wouldn't that be the correct read of the next sentence?
No, Your Honor, because
okay,
if you look at the last three sentences of the last three lines of the paragraph, it says, if the arresting officer has reasonable cause to believe that you are driving under the influence of drugs or a combination of drugs and alcohol, you may be required to allow the taking of a blood sample for chemical testing to determine the drug content of your blood, even if a breath sample was previously provided.
Counsel, I'm a little slow. Would you your client refused to allow a breath test to be taken?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Can your client be convicted of or be found to be in violation of this statute for refusing to have a breath test taken?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
What makes this case different is that the police officer made a conjunctive demand for both breath and blood in a single request. Mr. Shin was never told, you can consent to a breath test and refuse a blood test, and I won't charge you with refusal. He was asked to provide both things. The police officer demanded a search that was beyond his constitutional authority to demand, and the record amply supports this.
And the search would be invalid to that extent, but not to the extent he makes a request for something that is permissible.
Well, Your Honor, the problem here is that the officer made a conjunctive demand for both things and did not. Mr. Shin was never told he could submit to half the search and not the other half of the search. If the government asks for a search which, in its totality, goes beyond the scope of its constitutional authority, that search is unlawful. And Mr. Shin is entitled to stand on his rights with regard to that. And I want to make sure that I point out the parts of the record that support this position. In the statement of facts, all of the motions that were filed by the appellant were incorporated by reference. In his memorandum of law in support of acquittal at page 23 of the appendix, he argued specifically, stated in the statement of facts, the officer demanded of the defendant two tests without differentiating the breath test from the blood test alone. In the next sentence, that statement says, the defendant was asked in one question, in the conjunctive, whether without being informed that he could legally say no to blood. The Commonwealth never contested this in any of its responses to the pleadings filed by the appellant in this case, in the trial court. And the trial court's opinion refers to blood and or breath tests. The trial court's opinion says, thus, when the officer asked defendant to submit to a blood and or breath test after arresting him for drunk driving, the defendant had no constitutional right to refuse the breath test.
Did you say and or?
The trial court used that and or terminology, but the defendant's assertions of fact, which are incorporated into the record, specifically state that it was a conjunctive demand for both things, and that demand clearly exceeded the scope.
Could and or mean that perhaps the trial court did not accept the defendant's statements of fact?
No, Your Honor. We know that that's
defendant
not
says and the judge says and or. How are we to believe that the judge has accepted that as a fact that it would be binding upon us?
For two reasons, Your Honor. First, the court actually went on to analyze the constitutionality of the police officer's demand for blood in this case, meaning that if the issue was as simple as, well, the police officer asked for a breath test, he refused to give the breath test, therefore he's guilty of refusal and he has no constitutional right against that breath test, that's all the trial court had to say.
The mere fact that the judge analyzed it means that it was required in your mind?
Certainly this court doesn't analyze things as a matter of generosity.
What's your other reason?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You said there were two reasons.
The other reason is, once again, the statement of facts, the binding statement of facts says blood and breath. It doesn't put breath first. It doesn't say the officer asked for a breath test and then asked for a blood test. It says the officer demanded a blood and breath test.
But we don't have a finding of fact by the court to that effect. Is that correct?
You do, Your Honor. It is the binding statement of facts which the court endorsed on this appeal.
Okay. Well, it seems as though the way you're framing this argument, tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, it relies entirely on an inference for us to draw from the trial court's decision that your client was convicted of refusing a blood test. Is that right?
Well, I think there's two answers to that question, Justice Kelsey. And the first answer is the trial court may have simply erred. If the court reads the trial court's opinion as saying saying that, well, he refused the breath test and therefore he's guilty and we don't need to worry about the blood test, then the trial court has erred by doing that analysis because the statement of facts tells us that it was a conjunctive demand for both breath and blood. And
okay,
that would
well,
be
suppose just purely for argument's sake, not for concession's sake, but assuming that we're right, that the trial judge knew he wasn't issuing a civil penalty for failure to comply with the blood test. He was only doing it for the breath test because that's the way he looked at the case. Does that mean your analysis is over under Birchfield?
Certainly Mr. Shin has no constitutional right to refuse a breath test, and therefore the unconstitutional conditions doctrine does not apply if he has no right against that search.
I'm just trying to make sure I'm not talking past you. So you would agree with that? So you're not agreeing that he was convicted only, that he was found to have a civil penalty associated with refusing a breath test only. You're not conceding that. But if that were true, doesn't that drop all the dominoes analytically for you?
If this court finds, not necessarily, but I will say this, if this court finds that only that a breath test was demanded in isolation, which Shin had the opportunity to refuse in isolation, the court found those facts, then certainly the unconstitutional conditions doctrine argument would
be dead. And the self-incrimination and all the rest of that would fall as well. So the whole case really does turn on our reading of this trial court record to suggest that the refusal was based on blood.
Not entirely, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why. I agree with the premise, though, that if the court made that specific factual conclusion from the record, then the unconstitutional conditions doctrine argument would go away. But that doesn't mean that Mr. Shin wasn't reasonable to refuse as a matter of law. And the primary reason for that is that the police officer had no authority to demand a blood test under pain of criminal punishment. Birchfield tells us that, and although this case occurred prior to the United States Supreme Court's decision in Birchfield, the police officer made those demands for breath and blood under pain of criminal punishment. And United States versus Booker tells us that those rules go retroactively to cases that are still underway, even if they occurred before the decision of the court. And so the fact that there's a civil conviction in this case where he initially refused a criminal assertion by the police officer is irrelevant. Mr. Shin was prejudiced by that. When the police officer says, I'm gonna take this blood from you, and if you don't let me do it, I'm going to charge you with a crime, and Mr. Shin refuses, he can't go, when the government amends the charge downward, he can't then say, okay, well, now you can have my blood. He was frozen in time with that decision.
Can I interrupt one more time? So let me take you broader from your present argument. Suppose, in fact, the officer said, yeah, look, the way I look at this, you've got to give your blood up, period. And I'm really not concerned about the breath test. So as he did exactly what you're saying, actually, you claim he did do, it's still a civil penalty. And, I mean, I know that I see the analogies you're drawing to other cases, but there's no post-Birchfield case that binds us that says that the Birchfield doctrine applies to that context in a pure civil penalty case as opposed to a criminal case. So what's the best argument that we really don't have a choice, we have to go that far? Under your first predicate.
The best argument that he can't be punished civilly is that if the police officer is taking blood, the unconstitutional conditions doctrine prohibits that. Beyond that, there's no authority for the... And that starts on the basis that McNeely says the police officer needs a warrant to take your blood. If the legislature can legislate away the warrant requirement by implying consent to you for this, they can do it for anything. And if that's the government's position, that's an extremely expansive...
But warrants are required for criminal matters, for searches associated with criminal matters. There's a lot of ways the government would otherwise violate the Fourth Amendment when they're doing a pure civil enforcement action. Many ways, actually. So,
Your Honor, the Supreme Court of the United States has twice stated, and in fact the words in camera are, it's anomalous to say the Fourth Amendment applies only when the individual is suspected of criminal behavior. It's abundantly clear that the Fourth Amendment applies to protect Mr. Shin's blood inside of his veins from an invasive search of it without a warrant, whether it's a criminal or civil case.
Even though the ultimate penalty is a civil penalty, not a criminal penalty.
Yes, Your Honor, that's the position.
Has Birchfield been pushed that far?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor? Has Birchfield been pushed that far?
Birchfield, by its own terms, does not require this court to conclude that the civil penalty for refusal of a blood test is unconstitutional. McNeely does. McNeely tells you they need a warrant, and if they don't have a warrant, they can't legislate my consent. The Assembly can't legislate my consent to a search that I don't actually consent to. Mr. Shin refused. There's no basis to believe that he consented within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. If the court wouldn't mind, I'd like to save my remaining 1 minute and 13 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Trevor Cox from the Attorney General's Office for the Commonwealth. Your Honors, the Commonwealth asks that the Court uphold Shin's one-year license revocation, a civil penalty, for refusing to submit to alcohol testing for four reasons. First, there's no unconstitutional conditions problem here with 18.2-268.3 because Shin was clearly only civilly punished for refusing to submit to alcohol testing. The Supreme Court in Birchfield squarely said that it was not calling into question civil penalties under implied consent laws like the one we have here.
Counsel, would you jump to his argument that there was a demand for both blood and breath supported by the statement of facts and the trial court's opinion, and if so, what impact that might have on
our
analysis?
Yes, Justice Powell. The statement of facts does indicate that, for instance, on JA-66, the arresting police officer demanded a blood and breath test from the defendant first orally and then by means of reading him the implied consent declaration. Shin presumably read the implied consent declaration. And that's consistent with the statute and the refusal form on page 73 and 74, which says it's going to be read to you and then you're going to read it and sign it. So I think what the written statement does is say the statute was followed. It's Virginia Code 18.2-268.2B. And so he really hangs his hat on the fact that that language means that a blood test was demanded. But it's equally clear that a breath test was demanded and refused. And there's nothing in the record to suggest that they then had to go on to a blood test because it was unavailable. Or it couldn't be given for some other reason. And I will say that Mr. Shin has not been completely consistent in that representation about what happened. On page 64 of the joint appendix in the notice of appeal, it says that the civil offense was for unreasonably refusing to have samples of his blood or breath taken in violation of 268.3. And I don't think there's any question here that he did refuse a breath test, and that's sufficient. The court's opinion, letter opinion of September 20th, 2016, which is incorporated in the final order and the statement of facts, says on page J46, the defendant was given notice of being administered a breath test, and his refusal was unreasonable under the statute. So that's enough. And to a number of your honors' questions.
For the purpose of this question, let's give his argument the benefit of the doubt. So in other words, the police officer said, I'm demanding both breath and blood. And I'm going to add this. Mr. Shin then said, well, I'm willing to give you breath, but not blood. And the police officer then says, no, and means and. I want breath and blood. Those aren't your facts. But if those were your facts, would you be able to make the same argument?
I would. I still think there's no unconstitutional condition doctrine because he was only civilly punished. And Birchfield only called into question criminal penalties for refusing to give a blood test. The court said in Birchfield, nothing that they said in that case should be read to call into doubt the implied consent laws that all 50 states have enacted in order to keep public highways safe. And that's been consistently the position of the U.S. Supreme Court, going back to at least South Dakota versus Neville in 1983, where they said license revocation was, quote, unquestionably legitimate. And it also carries through the McNeely case that Mr. Shin hangs his hat on, where they obliquely suggested that that implied consent laws are okay. It says states have a broad range of legal tools to enforce drunk driving laws and to secure BAC evidence without undertaking warrantless non-consensual blood draws. For example, all 50 states have adopted implied consent laws. So because he's only penalized with a civil penalty, I don't think that he has an argument here that there's an unconstitutional condition that's been imposed on him.
But why couldn't we segment the statement? I mean, and so if a police officer says, well, I see what looks like a weapon in your waistband, I want to pat you down, and I also want to search your house without a warrant. Well, okay, it's a unitary statement. On the one, he has to cede because there's reasonable articulable suspicion the suspect is armed and dangerous. But the suspect could say, I'm not opening your door, you can't get in the house. I don't know why you have to take everything in a unitary sense and just say, well, it is reasonable to refuse an unconstitutional blood test, but it's not reasonable for the breath.
Right, and if there had been two individual tests here and a breath test was taken and then a blood test was also taken, he might have had a good argument that the blood test results should have been suppressed because of the threat, the criminal threat. And what the General Assembly has done in reaction to Birchfield is to segment the penalties, to make clear that you can't be criminally punished for refusing blood test results. I also think that Mr. Shin's other arguments do not hold water. He had no reasonable basis at the time for refusing the test. He says now that it's an unconstitutional condition that prevented him from consenting, but if you look at the court's opinion of September 20, 2016, again on JA 46, it says there in the middle of the page, as to the breath test, defendant was confronted with a lawful search. His, quote, his reason for refusing to take the test was that he did not believe he was intoxicated and should not have been subjected to such tests. And this court has held in the Cash versus Commonwealth case back in 1996 that one's subjective belief that one's not intoxicated is not a sufficient ground, a reasonable factual ground for refusing. If it were, it would eviscerate the meaning of the law. The drunker you are,
the more immune from prosecution you become.
Yes, Your Honor. The assignment of error involving unconstitutional vagueness, alleged unconstitutional vagueness, also falls flat. We think it's pretty clear that the statute prohibits certain kinds of conduct, and he's essentially asking for room for intoxicated individuals to be able to come up with many different factual reasons why they should be able to refuse. And it's pretty clear that the statute here prohibits the conduct that he was...
Are we limited to statutory text in this kind of vagueness challenge, or can we look at the decisions of the Court of Appeals, decisions of this court that construe the statute, because those give guidance to the public as well?
Well, this court has clearly dealt with this. This court has not. Lower courts have entertained vagueness challenges to this very statute.
You're trying to figure... I mean, there's all kinds of case law out there that says this is reasonable, this is not reasonable in this scenario. You want to talk to a lawyer that is or isn't reasonable. You feel ill or indisposed and you're physically unable to take it, that is or isn't reasonable. So when there's a vagueness challenge, I don't see why we couldn't look at the body of case law that authoritatively construes the statute as opposed to just being limited to the text of the statute itself.
I think Your Honor is right that this court's prior case law and case law from the Court of Appeals probably does illuminate what is reasonable in this context. I mean, there's at least three or four different cases that illuminate what is reasonable. It's not reasonable, for instance, to refuse because counsel advised you not to. It's not reasonable to refuse because you want to wait for counsel to advise you. It is reasonable to refuse if there's a health concern that prevents you from giving a breath test. So I think that case law is there for...
I was thinking something like the Sherman Antitrust Act, which has a criminal and a civil component, is very broadly written. I mean, you would have no idea what's prohibited by that, but there's over a century of case law that tells you with more or less clarity what you can and can't do. I mean, so there's one illustration of, I don't think it's vulnerable to a vagueness challenge because of that circumstance.
And I would point out also that just because there are a lot of cases out there that illuminate the meaning of it doesn't make it unconstitutionally vague. This court said in Fallon Florist that you can't legislate with mathematical precision, and you're going to have cases that give meaning to what is within the scope of conduct and what isn't. And then finally, on his fourth assignment of error, we don't think 268.3 is in tension with Article 1, Section 8 of the Virginia Constitution. For one, this is not a criminal proceeding. Two, the Article 1, Section 8 has been held by this court to have the same scope as the Fifth Amendment, and courts have found, both the U.S. Supreme Court in Schmerber back in 1966 and this court in Shoemate in 1967, that blood test evidence, even assuming that blood test evidence was asked for and refused here, That that's not testimonial or communicative within the scope of the Fifth Amendment, and therefore Article 1, Section 8. Be happy to answer any questions the court has. If not, we ask that the court affirm his civil penalty.
Rebuttal?
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you.
To begin with, the notice of appeal isn't inconsistent with any of the other factual statements in the case. It merely tracks the charging document, which uses the term breath or blood. With respect, the court discussed the question of whether civil penalties, or the Commonwealth discussed the question of whether the unconstitutional conditions doctrine applies to civil penalty. In Chandler versus Miller, the United States Supreme Court applied it to a purely civil consequence for refusing to undergo a warrantless.
But in Birchfield, the very case you're relying upon, the whole point of your case is Birchfield. They say our prior opinions have referred approvingly to the general concept of implied consent laws that impose civil penalties and evidentiary consequences on motorists who refuse to comply. Petitioners do not question the constitutionality of those laws, and nothing we say here should be read to cast doubt on them. You want to cast not more than doubt, you want to cast them into illegality.
Your Honor, to begin with, that quote itself says nobody in that case challenged the constitutionality of implied consent.
The point is, nothing we say here should be read to cast doubt. That's the
right,
court saying nothing they're saying in that opinion should create your argument.
Your Honor, we're not relying on Birchfield. We're relying on McNeely's statement that the Fourth Amendment requires a warrant before the police take blood from someone without an exception to the warrant requirement. If that doesn't mean anything, then I guess Mr. Shin would lose. But if the warrant requirement if the Fourth Amendment requires a warrant to take my blood, I should be able to say I refuse to comply with your test. Thank you.
Call the next case.